Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we should get started. What the heck? Well, thanks for coming, everybody. Thank you very much for coming, everyone, on this fine sunny afternoon in Hamilton. It's really a pleasure to be here for myself. My name is Jim Dunn. I'm at McMaster University, although I'm currently on sabbatical and feeling a little disconnected. So I'm in the process of reintegration. So that's why I feel a little. I do feel a little disconnected. But nevertheless, the reason we're here today, in fact, is to hear from Nathan Edelson, who is visiting Hamilton and whom we hope we can get some insights on a number of different topics. But a few of the things that are really interesting about Nathan's background and experience come from his work in the city of Vancouver, where he was a planner. And the things that are of particular interest to me are his work with the Urban Development Agreement in Vancouver, which was all over the byproduct of which was all over the news in the last week, and that was the decision around InSite, the supervised injection facility in Vancouver, which was one of not even a byproduct, a direct product of the Urban Development Agreement. And so I think that definitely there are going to be people in the audience who are interested in hearing about that. One of the other things is that Nathan is alleged to have coined the term revitalization without displacement. And I'll let him address that directly on your behalf. But that's another, I think, important issue. While certainly everybody around Hamilton is excited about the possibilities for our downtown and lower city and so forth, one of the things that lurks in the darkness in my mind and something that we really need to be wary of is the very real threat of displacement that can come from that and the limited window of opportunity we have to try and head that off, because once land prices start getting higher and higher, then that window will close. So, anyways, without any further ado, I'm going to let Nathan take the floor. He can tell you anything else that he wants to about his background that he thinks is relevant. I thought we might also do a little bit of a go around the room and get a sense of who's in the room and where they're coming from. And why don't we start with that, and then we'll have Nathan come up, and he's going to give some opening remarks and maybe even some fresh reflections from his morning. No pressure. And then he's going to talk for a bit, and then we're going to open the floor for just discussion. So that's the plan. You sure can. Yeah, you should turn around. No, exactly. You should start to see people's faces. And do you want to just get rid of it? Should we just move
this out of the way? Yeah.
So, can everybody see? Okay, so let's start in this direction. Where to start?
Well, listen, thank you. Julia Colic from Moving is Not an Option program with Environmental, a non-profit organization, and my program is working with the Tackle Poverty Initiative here in the local city.
My name is Judy Lee, and I work with Julia.
I'm Crystal Newman. I'm working on Good Food Boxes, a project in Vernon, Hamilton, bringing alternative produce distribution into areas where there isn't as much. And then I also work with Neighbor to Neighbor Center, which works on poverty eradication and prevention on the mountain. And there I run a single moms program, enabling them to become contributors in food.
Tom Mobley, poverty advocate, poor person. I also volunteer at Neighbor to Neighbor, and I'm on panel for HPS funding.
I'm Linda Godey. I'm working in public health. I'm focusing on making the community more activity friendly. My colleague is working on some diversity of housing.
My turn. Hi, I'm Diane Samokas. I'm from the School of Nursing at McMaster, and I'm working on a project with Health of the House, and I'm on the faculty here on table.
My name is Dan Peace. I own a small business in the stadium precinct, and I'm associated with the South Sherman Neighborhood Hub, and I'm the chairman of the Board of Mission Services.
I'm Suzanne O'Grady, and I'm with Fannie Community Services, and our organization has a community center in the McQuesten neighborhood, so we're strong supporters of that neighborhood, and our offices are located in the South Sherman Community Planning Team neighborhood. We are a sort of large community service-based organization with programs focusing on the city of Hamilton, but some in Kawartha's and Niagara area.
My name is Lauren Hurst. I'm a fourth-year McMaster
PRC, and we'll be doing a little bit of work with the Riverdale Hub.
I'm Mike Desjardins. I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator for the Hamilton Wentworth District School Board. I'm also on the Dallas Prosperity Club.
I'm April Morganti, and I'm the Manager of Partnership and Community Engagement for the Hamilton Wentworth District School Board.
I'm Sarah Mayo from the Social Planning Research Council. We have a number of projects related to this, including the affordable housing flagship that we're involved in and the city's redevelopment.
I'm Tony Mark. I'm with the Jobs Prosperity Collective.
Come back. Do you want to start?
I'm Steve Millen. I'm a landscaping company, but my background is in landscape architecture from University College.
I'm Kathy Walls. I'm with the Special Planning Research Network and the Community Council, and I sit on the round table for property protection.
I'm Kathy Dixon, and I'm the Community Center Center Instructor at the National Academy of Health and Wellness.
And I'm Elskita Fish-Iburton, and wear a few hats. So I'm with St. Vincent de Paul, which has Ontario-based Voices for the Poor with some initiatives. I'm the West Hamilton Wraparound Coordinator. So we do wraparound work in a community with the use of volunteers, linking trained wraparound facilitators with families whose lives are overwhelming and try to build a network around them. We succeed in building a network around families, and then some of our families then pay it forward and help other families in the same situation. And then some of that, I also have some World Vision money. So we're building capacity with the neighborhoods to try and engage volunteers to do the same thing for people, for the neighbors. So how do we help our neighbors? And we use the wraparound model doing that. So we have some World Vision funding, so we're doing it here in Hamilton, in the North End, and through some of the hubs. And then we're just doing it with Chatham Kent now, so I'm a little excited about that. So that's me.
I'm Jane Gaspoy. I'm a student at National Academy and Community Support Worker, as an instructor.
I'm Shea Olson. I'm also a student at National Academy Health and Business on Houston and King Street, and Kathy's my instructor.
I'm Gina Schreier, and I'm Hillary Gibson-Wood. I work at McMaster with Jim Dunn. I'm a research manager there, so I work on projects looking at, broadly speaking, neighborhoods and health and housing and health.
You look somehow familiar.
And I took a class as well when I was doing my MA in geography at U of T with Nate and Norma Jean.
And I'm Norma Jean McLaren. I guess in this context, I'm Nathan's wife. but I would like to just back up a little bit. He left the city of Vancouver and joined my company. I'm the senior partner.
Well said.
so it's been great because we're working together now a lot in the communities that I was before flying by myself. I work a lot in rural communities. I've worked a lot in the city of Vancouver, but now more in rural communities between Native, non-Native populations particularly, and immigrant communities also. And most recently have been involved using film as a way of crossing boundaries, particularly between police and the Aboriginal community. So tonight I'm actually showing the film to some of the Hamilton's finest. Yes. It's called The Spirit Has No Color. And we're also now working on getting the money for the Dream Film, which is a more across-Canada film on corrections and Aboriginal people, and changing that dichotomy and looking at the healing programs and community connection.
I'm Larry Strong. I worked for 20 years as an engineer in the auto industry, and I'm now a freelance photographer in Hamilton, probably best known for a project called Hamilton 365, where I did a portrait a day of a different individual in Hamilton. And through the course of that project, I became touched by the people that are living at risk in the city. And so I've been working for the last few years with different charities to help, I guess, identify the issues as well. So if you're interested in making use of them, please consider it as well. There's obviously a lot of people here that could do that.
Sandy Salorm, I'm presently doing a documentary called Code Red.
Code what?
Code Red. Code Red.
Oh, for the film.
no, I'm working independently, but it's part of that.
And I'm Jackie Lupervoid. I'm the coordinator of the Ontario Earlier Centers in Stony Creek Riding under the Hamilton West Catholic Child Care Centers.
And I'm Jen Dawson, a.k.a. Code Red Speaker at Yahoo.ca. Probably how most of you guys know me. I work with Jim to do some communications work and put on these events, and it's been so great, actually, to hear about some of the work that you guys are doing. I see your faces at the evening events we've had, but it's wonderful to actually hear a bit of background, so thanks for sharing that. I have a tape recorder here, and I just want to check if it's okay with everyone, if it's what we talk about is tape recorded. No objections? Great, thanks.
We won't publish it or anything.
We won't?
Yes, we will. It's going on your website. So with that being said, is everyone still comfortable with being tape recorded?
I'm going to stand just so you can hear me. I'm suffering from a combination of jet lag and deadlines, so I want to make sure you can hear me. If you can't, if I fade out, please yell. And I'm also going to read parts of the presentation because it's a new one for me. And I thought that the audience was going to be a bit different, but I'm going to do it anyway. And but be integrating some of the things we've been doing in Vancouver, particularly in the downtown east side. And hopefully there'll be a lot leads to some good discussion. Because of some of the things I've seen today, as well as just seeing the kind of groups that are coming out that are interested in this topic. I was going to begin by thanking Jim, actually, for inviting me. This is, what he did, it was, I realized this, I spent time in Toronto and some of the communities in eastern Canada, but I hadn't really had an opportunity to really see Hamilton. And I jumped at the opportunity to take a couple of days to be able to find out a bit more of what's going on. And this morning, I've actually genuinely been quite impressed, and you'll see why when I start speaking. But it had to do with what seemed to me to be, and you'll have to tell me if it's true or not, reasonably genuine levels of cooperation among different people at a neighborhood base. And it's not that we don't have that in Vancouver, but in Vancouver there's a bit of a different situation, which I'll speak to. But I was I was what you know from Norma Jean, that I'm the junior-senior partner in 42nd Street Consulting. For 25 years before that, I was a bureaucrat in residence with the City of Vancouver Planning Department. And before that, I was the founding executive director of Blue Mountain Neighborhood House in the center of Vancouver. In my work in Vancouver, it started right after, or just before Expo 86, working on the neighborhoods near the rapid transit, the first rapid transit line, which I believe was the technology was built here, and we used to have industry. But we did what would now be called transit-oriented development around the stations. But we also put a focus on, in our community processes, of trying to make sure we'd be improving the quality of life for existing residents, not just accommodating the needs of new residents. And that was a big central part of why that planning program was particularly popular in some areas. In others, it wasn't, because they were getting an elevated SkyTrain that said Hamilton all over it. After that, I worked in a number of neighborhoods on a number of citywide issues that were quite contentious, but worked in the downtown south area near Granville Street. For those, how many have been to Vancouver? Okay, so, and how many have heard of the downtown east side? Okay, so that's helpful. The downtown south was the old warehouse area that was transformed into a high-density residential neighborhood, but it's the place where we made two fundamental commitments for the first time in the city. One was a one-for-one replacement of the single-room occupancy hotels, the small, 100, generally 100-square-foot rooms where the bathrooms down the hall that a lot of low-income people in Vancouver live in. But we made a commitment of a one-for-one replacement of those SROs with social housing. And through all this sturm and drag of development and so on, we pretty much kept to that. The other was a new community center, a downtown south gathering place, and a health clinic in anticipation of the need, well, not anticipation, knowing the needs of a lot of the street youth and others that were in that part of the city. And there's a number of other innovations that came into that program. But then I was so used to dealing with controversy that they decided to move me to work in the downtown east side in the early 90s, mid-90s. And that's what I'll speak about this afternoon. And for 15 years, I was the senior planner, which doesn't mean I was the boss of bosses. The planning department is one department in the city. But it put me in a good place, because one of the lessons that my boss, and some of you may have heard of Larry Beasley, for those who follow planning, but he, I was kind of his social arm as we'd worked together for so many years. But he also, when I get worried that we weren't invited to this meeting or that meeting about some issue that I thought was important to community planning, he would just kind of be relaxed and say, well, eventually they're going to need a development permit, so they got to come to this desk anyway. If they don't want me there, they'll come to me. And it kind of gave me a little bit of relaxation. Like the planning department or community planning is not just land use planning, but it's really can engage itself in trying to build stronger communities in a variety of ways, with land use as one of the tools that does that. In all these neighborhoods, I've had a chance to work with the low-income community. It's been an interest of mine, and I'll talk a bit more about that. In the downtown east side, roughly 75% of the population is low-income, some among the most destitute in the country. But it includes a mix of people even within that population. There's the retired and injured resource workers, people who actually fought the original battles over that neighborhood, which was going to be changed in any number of ways over time. But it also includes a large and increasing number of younger people, people with mental illness and who are addicted to drugs or alcohol, single-parent families, one of the largest urban Aboriginal populations and communities in Canada as well. So it's a real mix of people and interests, and as many other interests within what we call low-income community. Some are there because they have no choice. Many are there because it's their community. Just like any of us, it's a place they're comfortable in, and they've established a cultural connection. But in Vancouver, and this is a bit of a difference, at least right now for Hamilton, but you may be, I can give you a preview of what you may face if you do indeed become West Toronto, as the GO-Train or whatever other systems make you more accessible. Economic forces threatening to gentrify the area and to displace the poor. And the question for Vancouver officials was, should we let this happen? And, you know, because it's kind of some councillors and people in the city felt, yes, this is good land in the inner city, it's going to rise in value, and why shouldn't people just go where they go home? And or if we're building low-income housing, why not build it out at the edge of the city where we could build more for a dollar, because land is cheap? Should we let it happen? Should we encourage it from happening? Or should we try to stop it from happening? And that was a central issue that the city had to grapple with over a number of years. And it was a full debate about what the options would be. We chose to try to fight it. And partly in terms of the question of the concentration of poverty, which is one of the questions I guess will be addressed tomorrow, we honestly couldn't find any evidence that the concentration of poverty meant very much one way or the other. Like, what was the number? What was the population per square inch or per square meter or mile when there were too many poor people congregated in one place? We couldn't find, maybe there is more evidence than we would bother to look for. But the second is, you have to think of yourselves, how many of you have been either a community planner or in a situation like a community planner in going to a community meeting to present a proposal? Okay, well, I've been in a lot of contentious meetings. I'll tell you, usually I wouldn't allow this kind of design. I want to be on the other end of the room and have you facing this way. And the reason for that, survival. So we're going to, okay, so you, now you're the downtown east side community. You're the, this half is the retired resource workers. And this side is the young people addicted to drugs, and there's a few homeowners back, way in the back. And so we're going to go and say, okay, we're going to do this major investment in your community, and we're going to make all these improvements to housing, commerce, we're going to fill those empty stores, we're going to provide some health clinics and do this and this. But of course, about 40% of you are actually not going to be in that neighborhood. Well, that's when you want to be on the other side of the door. So just in terms of just survival principles of planning, to do a community planning process to tell people that they're not going to be part of the future of the neighborhood is kind of, you shouldn't engage them if you can do that. There's a part of it that just didn't make sense. And when you, the reason why I say that is, would you do that in a wealthier community? Would you actually tell people, well, actually, we're going to move out these blocks to make way for a brand new low-income housing project because there's too many rich people here. So when we started doing the work, have any of you heard of David Lay? He's a geographer. He's done a lot of work. David Holchansky?
Yes.
Yeah, David's from U of T. He was at UBC, as is David Lay. He's the head of the geography department there. Both of them, plus Nick Blomley, are international experts in the forces of gentrification. And we had lots of discussions about what to do when we started the planning program. And they basically said, you might as well get people to start packing their bags. The downtown east side is, in Vancouver is too centrally located, too many heritage buildings, great views of the mountains and water, and nice parks. It's going to be gentrified. You might as well accept it, and there'll be a few social housing units left over, and that'll be your low-income population. Well, it was hard to go back to that room of community people with that advice, as well as it wasn't what we thought was either among staff or council was the right thing to do. So we started looking carefully at the forces of gentrification. Now, I'll oversimplify them dramatically. But basically, the first thing that happens, and you may experience this over the next couple of years, wealthier, people with more income, not necessarily the very rich, people with more income start to come in, either renting units for a higher price or buying units, and gradually making it unaffordable for the for portions of the low-income community. It can happen quickly, happen gradually, but there's just a constant pressure, a rising tide of land values. The second is that, basically I'll summarize it, the Starbucks replaces the local coffee shop. It's more expensive. The quality may be worth the difference for some people, but others just can't fit in the room. Then the new businesses that come in and the new homeowners tend to form an alliance. And they start phoning people like the police to say, is it people loitering here? This, you know, and there's that food lineup and they're littering and, you know, I pay good money to be in this neighborhood. So there's a change in the control of the streets and low-income residents become strangers in their own community if the police go on board with that. And often they do. And then finally, somebody says, well, we have a lot of people from McMaster come and they've done the study and they say, we need so many more, we need this kind of health facility or that social service to address these needs. Here's all the evidence. And people turn around and say, there's too many services here now. And these services just attract more low-income people. It's kind of like breeding a virus. They'll just be attracted to it and grow and grow. So we don't want them anymore. And it becomes tremendous opposition, not just to the new proposals, but even putting pressure on existing agencies and services. And already the market is putting pressure on them as well, because they're some of them have gotten into cheap rents in their commercial space, and they're facing increased costs of doing business. So that's roughly the process. And so our strategy was to try to say, okay, what can we do to reverse this? And what are the things we need to do to come to grips with those forces? So the first was a housing plan. And we went back to the idea at the core of that, a commitment to a one-for-one replacement of the single-room occupancy rooms to protect the existing ones as long as they were needed, but to commit to replacing them with purpose-built social housing where people could even have their own kitchen or bathroom. Or at least if we couldn't afford to do that or until we could afford to do that, publicly owned SROs that were renovated and better managed by the nonprofit system in a variety of ways. So that's we made that as a public policy in our housing plan. There might be some arguing. That came after several years of discussion with the various interests in the community. But anywhere we went, if we didn't get to that point of at least the one for one replacement, we were in that situation that we would be, this side of the room that we were trying to leave would be probably pretty upset. Yes.
When you went for, was it always one for one replacement in that neighborhood?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Because we have plenty of low-income people in other parts of the neighborhood, they're just not as, of the city, they're just not as visible. But so whether the principle is exactly right, at least we're talking about 10,000 units, and at that time we had 4,000 social housing units in that place, so 6,000 to go. And I think now we're up to about 5,500 or 6,000, so we still have a lot to go because of changes in provincial and federal policies in terms, with respect to housing. But the notion was there, the principle was there, that's what we're setting our targets on. And then how do we protect the existing stock as long as possible while it's still needed, even though some of it is stuff you wouldn't want your children or people or anyone to necessarily be second to the street. That was the central thing. And we also worked on community economic development. And we had an economic revitalization plan which said we will be attracting more business. There's a lot of space in the downtown east side. But we want to put an emphasis on people, on social enterprise, where they will employ local residents, train them, or provide affordable commercial services, as well as private sector businesses, some of whom may partner in those kind of initiatives, if they could, if they could hire local residents to provide incentives for them to do that. Various looking at different ways of engaging the police in more of a community-based notion of policing, and a sense that they couldn't just respond to one group. And there's lots of work, some success, some pushback. Things change over time. But probably one of the high tides of that initiative, most of you have heard of the missing women in Vancouver, which is like a hallmark of one of the terrible sides of what's happening in not just in downtown Eastside, but for British Columbia and Canada. And when that happened, some of the toughest police on our force, the ones that you didn't really want to necessarily be in the room with, they initiated something where they started training sex trade workers in self-defense, and then training them in being able to train others, a peer model, which has now been taken over by one of the community organizations. But it was that notion that they were engaged in this, and we were looking at ways, and I haven't quite gotten there yet, but my hope is ultimately that they may be engaged in more of a community process, a community safety process of training others. This is it's part of what I'll be getting at in terms of the point of when we see somebody, do we really see them, and how do we relate to them? But that was one of the, we saw those kind of examples. That's a real story, is it? And the program is not, the police still liaise with it. They don't do the training at this point because of the preparatory reasons. And we put a lot of work into developing inclusive public spaces, programming of public space, community arts, and other initiatives, which I'll speak to. So the housing plan also talks about a mix of housing. It puts a particular emphasis beyond the one-for-one replacement. You can quibble over, should it be one-for-one or should it be 1.2-for-1 because it's a growing low-income. So one-for-one, I'd say let's argue once we get to 9,000 units. but we put a big emphasis on affordable rental housing. And we did that for a couple of reasons. One is, in the long term, do you want a neighborhood that's all just whatever the market will bear and market housing and very poor people, or do you want a mix of ranges? Also, there's a lot of support and service workers and some warehouse and other kind of light industrial workers, jobs in the inner city, and people who work in those jobs should have the opportunity not to have to commute from as far out now as Abbotsford. And these are people who don't necessarily make a big wage, and giving them a chance to live in the inner city by policy. And finally, if someone did make it out of poverty, would their next stop have to be Abbotsford, or could they stay within a community if they wanted to? A whole bunch don't. They're there by circumstance. A lot would like to, because that's where their home and their connections are. So I think, like many of you, I suspect, are supportive of mixed-income neighborhoods. And we've lived in them for years in Vancouver. People talk about, well, can you do a housing mix and stuff? Well, we've lived in neighborhoods all over the city that have mixes of income and done that successfully for generations. It's not a scientific question. It's just a fact. And the question is, when there's many a concentration of people with significant challenges, how do you do that? Well, my sense is that there's a number of things that can be done to make that happen. It may require more programming, more conscious things than the neighborhoods where this has evolved over time and so on. But that's something that many of us, in, at least in Vancouver, are quite committed to, that these neighborhoods can work. It's a matter of how do you get the right resources and so on so that people can, that might not be used to living with one another or near one another, can do so. I came back to the conclusion that I didn't think it was the numbers of low-income people that was the critical thing in terms of the health of the community. And we looked at a person, have any of you heard of Bruce Alexander? He's been very influential in Vancouver. He was a psychology professor at SFU, and I hate to recognize that at the university, but
that's my alma mater.
It's Norma Jean and I are the other side of the hall. Bruce was a retired, is now a retired professor. He wrote a book called The Globalization of Addiction. And he said that many of us suffer, or most of us suffer from addictions. Smoking, alcohol, shopping, food, too much, too little, work. You know. And so he looked at where do addictions come from, as well as illegal drugs and alcohol. He was looking at what are the sources of that. And what he found was, his conclusion, and he started with the rats in the laboratories right up to full-grown human beings, some of whom might have been rats at some point. And he found that it was the sense of loss of control, the dislocation, the rapid period of change of things we can control, that when you're on that video game, damn it, you can at least control the mouse or whatever. But it's almost in that moment when you're doing something that has that obsession that you have a common bond with the person who's spending most of the day trying to figure out how to afford the next hit of cocaine or heroin or whatever. And that the addictions are quite prevalent in our society, something that we have to be sharing in common. And what he said, so what Dr. Alexander said, if the symptom is addiction and the cause is dislocation, or sense of dislocation, lack of control, that the cure is community, a sense of belonging, a sense that you'll be looked after, and that you have something to contribute to others. And he gives a lot of examples of this kind of thing. So the question becomes then, how do we build a sense of community? I know a lot of you are working on this. I was expecting a bit of a different audience around this, but I'll say it anyway, because it's stuff you know, and I'll give you some downtown side examples. But how do we build it? Well, first, often it comes from struggle. In Downtown East Side's case, in the 1960s and 70s, there was a huge struggle. How many of you heard of Libby Davies, member of Parliament? Well, she was married to probably the closest to a Renaissance person I've ever met. Her husband passed away a number of years ago, who became a friend of Bruce Erickson. They formed the Downtown East Side Residents Association, and they participated in huge, active political struggles. And they put the term Downtown East Side on the map. That's where it came from. They said, we're a community. There's real people living here. It's not Skid Row. It's not the slum. You know. And it's interesting that some people said, well, we should change the name Downtown East Side because that's such a bad label. And we're saying, don't you dare. People died for that. Second is then for survival. One of the first issues they took on were putting sprinklers in the SROs. Every year, people were dying in fires. People would be drunk, they'd fall asleep, the mattress would go on fire. There were deaths every year, many. And Bruce led a campaign to stop that. He took another campaign to stop the over-serving of alcohol in the pubs. And in each case, he was said, you're crazy. If you do this, you're going to jeopardize the basic housing you're trying to protect, that landlords won't afford it. Well, the legislation came in, the sprinklers were put in, and the deaths dramatically dropped. But it's similar to fighting for a needle exchange. Canada's first needle exchange is in Vancouver, I believe. And then, of course, the supervised injection. So it comes out of struggle, in a sense, that people as individuals and as a community matter, and that their survival, their life safety is important. And then for gathering, huge battles over places like the Carnegie Community Center, which if you go to Vancouver, it should be listed as one of our top tourist attractions, because it's an incredible place. You'll see a whole community's living room, people living in quite good harmony, different cultures, different languages, quite peacefully, and engaged in feeling ownership over. Another example is Oppenheimer Park, and the role that even now the Japanese play in the design of that park, because that was the place they were rounded up from and evicted from Canada or from the coast in World War II, and still have strong feelings about. But the design of that park was intentionally designed to respect its important heritage. Political power. People starting to vote, organizing voting drives, and running for office. An enterprise. Any of you heard of a group called United We Can? It's a bottle recycling plant that's owned by the Binners, the very poorest people. You go in there, and it's a hub of activity. You won't find harder working people in any city than the people who scrounge, what Ken Loyote says, scratch for a living in the dumpsters and other places, and are part of a leading edge of our environmental issues. They're doing recycling big time. But it's their institution. They have spin-off businesses from that. For nutrition, the Potluck Cafe that offers food security for lots of low-income residents, but runs a restaurant, but makes its money in order to provide some food security by providing excellent catering services across the city. And when you buy from them, they market the downtown east side. You can be contributing to food security for low-income people while you're paying no more than you would from other. For expression, the Heart of the City Festival, which if you're ever in Vancouver in the October-November period, is an amazing display of community talent, but it's one of dozens of community arts initiatives and programming in the public space, where you see people who at times would appear to be invisible suddenly performing beautiful opera, blues or jazz, or writing poetry, or performing in different ways, or just selling tickets or making a set, being part of the community. One of my favorites is the St. James Music Academy. And this is a group that was started by an amazing family. They had six children and they got lots of kids. The Music Academy. That now about 150 kids go every day of the week for music lessons by professional musicians. And they're improving. The first year or two we went to hear their concerts, it was kind of out of obligation. Now they're actually pretty good. But making a real difference. Because what they're teaching the kids is, and they teach them classical music for the most part. They're doing something that's hard, and that they can do it. They can master it. And that they also, they find out that they're not invisible. That if they don't show up, it makes a difference. They're part of a team. And the effects on the parents are the El Sistema music market from Venezuela.
Get them there on the walking school bus from the school.
Oh, that's awesome.
Walking through the school.
Wow.
So developing a local culture of caring and tolerance for difference, for acting in the political world, for being capable, building capacity, which so many of you do, or what is sometimes called social capital. In Vancouver, the downtown east side is surrounded by strong real estate and market forces and the forces of gentrification. There's no question about that. The housing plan is one of the bulwarks against that. And in the future, it's likely that there will be a mix of incomes there. But it'll evolve, and these other supports need to be there for that kind of community to make sense. I think that Hamilton faces a different challenge, at least right now, although it may be changing. And I was just going to speak briefly to that, and I'll sit down. It's the lack of investment. Your land values are lower. They haven't been climbing. You don't have people buying over some of the inner city property at the rate that they may in the future, or that they certainly are in Vancouver. It happened for some time. So in a sense, I've done some work in rural British Columbia with some of the First Nations. And it's a very different way of doing planning. In Vancouver, every cubic centimeter is expensive. So in the First Nations, you've got lots of land. And you're somewhere in between. You know, I'm sure it's not cheap to buy stuff relative to your budget, but it's not as constrained as in Vancouver or as it may be in a few years. So the opportunity to do innovative things. And when people aren't being forced out the door, the urgency of homelessness today, you build that housing as quickly as you can afford to do, becomes more of an urgency in Vancouver. But here, there may be the time to do something that we've been encouraging some of the First Nations to consider, which is a kind of import substitution. Like, if you survey people in rural First Nations, and we've done this, people will talk about they want to do cultural tourism. Well, there's just so many people going from Williams Lake that's dying to go camping in Tweedsmuir Park that want to buy an artifact on a reserve. There's some, but to make that as your economic strategy may be challenging. That doesn't mean it's not a good idea to study your culture and to know the things you would need to do that, and to instill pride in young people, to learn about how the environment survived under their management of it for thousands of years. All those things are important. But things like learning how to fix up your house, how to make it energy efficient, maybe how to get into community gardening or growing some of your own food, some of the innovative alternative energy as well, those kind of things that would reduce your costs and also give you an opportunity to learn skills in both construction and management and maintenance of things that you need anyway, in addition to high-tech, broadband and other things, maybe a better way for some of the First Nations to go. And they also have more land to work with. And I guess you're somewhere in between, in the knowledge of it. But some of those things could be done and might be very valuable ways of preserving or improving the housing stock and also engaging people in the management and maintenance of it, and those kind of skills. Food security, I think some of you are working on, and teaching about the local culture. So I'm going to wrap up by just saying I think that we need a better understanding of who we are as Canadian people as a starting point in working on these kind of issues. In these times of overconsumption, unstable economies, and fragile environments, how can we be sure which parts of our culture are leading edge, which skills will really be needed in the future? Addiction is something that affects all of our lives, and it may be worthwhile to look for leadership in those who have gone through the pains of the worst of our society has to offer. Abuse, addiction, hunger, humiliation, and who have come back with a sense of compassion and confidence. They may be the social coal that's transformed to diamond, who have things to teach low-income people in their communities and to help lead all of us. And that's the main lesson I've come through, just the experience of working with people and seeing the transformations and what people are capable of. And I'm not advocating that as a life path for believe me, but it's something when we're looking at people to realize that this may be the person who can teach you self-defense, if you know it. It may be the person, or it may be the person who's murdered in the streets and the police don't even know it for a decade. So it's kind of the way that we look at the communities and how we build communities and why we build them. And that's all I'm saying.
Okay, so you can you drink us the floor is open for questions, open discussion.
What started the gentrification? Did they just start out of land in the burbs?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. Vancouver is more limited, but also the downtown, when we did, I'll tell you a trick of planning, which I didn't realize until I was doing Downtown South. There's a strong relationship between planning and real estate marketing. And we actually formed alliances, and we developed kind of a sense that it was interesting to live in the downtown. It was a big change, and it started in Downtown South and the Concord projects along Falls Creek. So people became reinterested in the downtown. But the real lever was when we started running out of downtown land that was easy to develop for high-rise development. That's when the economic forces started turning on the downtown east side. There are still protections in the zoning and in policy, but it wouldn't take, there's only about 3 regulations that protect that area from wholesale redevelopment. And it's three or four things, along with a couple thousand people who are organized and will mobilize against every permit. But the real thing had to do with just where people wanted to live near the downtown, and they're running out of alternatives.
Maybe just
is that a follow-up, Sam?
Yeah, in terms of the three zoning and policy instruments that the city has in place to protect the area, can you just briefly outline them?
Okay, well, one of them is that in part of the... It's a medium density area, so the heights are restricted to around 100 feet, roughly. It's more or less in some areas. As opposed to 300 or 400 feet in other parts of the city, of the downtown. Second is that in a big part of the downtown east side, the zoning says that if you're going to build a new building or add to an existing building, 20% of the space has to be for low-income housing. And that's the fragile one, because it was protecting for a long time, but now there are actually proposals coming, starting to be formulated that could do that. So what's the outcome of the zoning? 80% of the space is for market housing, 20% for low-income housing.
It comes under your own success in a way.
Yeah, but also, the other thing that happens is that some developers say, look, I just need $10 more and I can do this. I can get rid of that slum building, that terrible building that's in awful condition that has to be torn down anyway. If you get rid of this regulation.
10 more stories, yeah.
Yeah,
$10 more. Right, yeah.
He knew what he meant. Low income is not necessarily geared to income. So you're still going to drive people up.
What's that?
Low income housing is not necessarily geared to income.
When we talk about low income housing, the one-for-one replacement, the commitment there, and it took us a while to... some of my best friends are housing planners. Okay? But they were playing a bit with the numbers, and we finally said, look, when we talk about one-for-one replacement, we don't mean like when you have a housing co-op and a third of the units are for low end of market, and then there's maybe a third of core need, or two-thirds maybe. We just want to count the numbers that are core need housing, so the people who can be on social assistance and live in those units. That's what the commitment was
for. I have a question related to elementary, well, especially elementary schools. Was there a closure of schools or had any effect? Because I know in terms of Hamilton downtown core, there's closing of schools, and that certainly affects where the kids are bused out and the community.
Not on the downtown east side. Well, there's one school that was in danger of it, and they found another use. And now there's a lot of artists in the downtown east side as well, and they're starting to look towards Seattle, where they've created art centers, some of which still have the school in it, but the artists are part of the teaching staff as well as using the facilities. But there's one school at the eastern edge of the downtown east side that's in danger. There was a big battle this year because I think the school board was going to close about five or six schools, and there was tremendous resistance to it. They were all on the east side of the city, not necessarily the inner city. And so far they haven't closed them, but it's an issue that's going to come back because of the population change and I guess reduced funding probably in relation to some of the needs of larger immigrant communities and so on. And the special needs kids have been integrated into the Vancouver school system. Are more expensive than to teach in that way than has been there traditionally. But right now, it's still an issue, but they haven't closed them yet.
A couple of questions on this side of the room.
So, the downtown east side, Libby Davies, well, what influence did a local planning team, you know we have local planning teams here that are very strong, so what is the influence of a local planning team in shaping the agenda? I'm thinking about the Pan Am Games and maybe South Sherman, Crown Point. What advice would you give?
I think in the case of the, if people came from different parts of the organization to work in the downtown east side, it becomes an addiction itself. I've been a junior partner for 3 years now, but I'm still involved with some of the downtown east side issues. And one person was I worked together. She had done the original plan for downtown south, and I took over the implementation of it. She moved to the housing center. She was the housing planner for it.
Another person who worked in social planning and moved to the manager's office and managed a big pot of money for us. We call it the Bank of Wendy. Donald McPherson, who did the Four Pillars strategy, he had been the head of the Carnegie Community Center. So people kind of gravitated when we saw the program was emerging, and we tried to recruit people and young people that we thought would have similar commonality. Do we have an influence? Yeah. And part of why we have an influence is probably disproportionate was because of the divisions within the community. And some of them were heartbreaking. You know, between agencies fighting over limited dollars or different approaches. Rather than getting into a mode of let's try different things, let's monitor, evaluate, see what's working, what's not, it became this group's getting everything. Or, you know, this is favoritism here. Much more of that kind of attitude, let alone what would happen between some parts of the market community and the low-income community. So a lot of the work that I did was trying to get groups to try to work together. And we developed a kind of a notion of, we went to different constituents and said, what are your top priorities? What do you need most? And if we thought that they were in the public interest, if we could make a case for that, and that they wouldn't harm the interests of other groups, we would try to do it. And we didn't require anything. It was kind of like unconditional planning law. We just said, and it wasn't small issues. It wasn't just like the flower, oh, we'd like a flower pot in front of our street. It was things like a supervised injection site or health clinics or the housing plan protections or bylaws concerning the residential hotels or over $120 million of city incentives for heritage buildings in Gastown or major program for revitalizing Chinatown and respecting the family association buildings and the public realm interests of the Chinatown had requested. But what we said to them was, we're not going to do this for you if you do something for us. We said, that's your business. If you want to support, we're going to do certain things. We don't care what you think. We'd love your support, but we're not requiring it. But we said, if there's another organization that you might not normally work with, and the two of you came back with a joint proposal, we'll try to give that top priority for implementing. And we did that, and in a number of cases, that became, at a certain point, that was very powerful. That kind of approach has to be reintroduced all the time. It's not a given that it will always work. But at one point, we had virtually all the major groups in the Downtown East Side, including the business groups, supporting the same proposal for Woodward's, even though it contained things that both groups had sworn they didn't want, market housing and social housing, social services and other things. And yet they supported it because they could see it. The supervised injection site, the first group to come out publicly to support the supervised injection site when the federal government decided to try to close it down, was the Chinatown Business Association, which had a couple of years before opposed a basic public health clinic. And that was all based on this kind of giving and taking.
It's been very interesting, to say the least, doing this filming. Because initially, my heart really went out to the poor, and it still does to a point. I can't believe I'm hardening and I'm actually admitting this, but I think that's what's going to make it really powerful. And that is, the more organizations I go to, the more speakers I listen to, we have to allow the poor to take responsibility. Where I'm coming with that is, I'm currently filming the skateboarders in the Beasley area, because I wanted to bring some kind of a light to such a hard subject. Poverty is such a hard subject, I don't want people to think. Anyway, so I'm filming them at Beasley Park, I'm watching the kids, I'm interacting with the kids, and there's garbage everywhere. All right, now Beasley Park is one of the areas that's going through refurbishing right now. I also went up to Turner Park and I filmed the kids skateboarding there, which is a brand new facility that the city has spent a fortune. And there's also lots of garbage. The kids' attitude is the city's going to clean it up. So what I'm trying to say is, how can we encourage, inspire, entice these kids, let's talk about the kids, to take responsibility to respect their environment, because the kids are the future. So let's focus with them. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I absolutely agree with that. And we had one member of our team was an astoundingly good city engineer, and he was ahead of our time, because now there's so many good engineers in terms of environment and even social issues, it's unbelievable. I got tired, toward the last year or two, when I go to meetings, I was tired of looking to my left at the better ideas coming from the engineers. It was so shocking, because for years I could count on them being way to the right and ridiculous. But this engineer had done things, he was very concerned about public washrooms and access to them in the downtown east side. And it was a big issue. There's very few public washrooms. If you can't afford a coffee or whatever, you can. And at one point he would count the number of people. He'd count the toilet paper use. He was just looking at everything to try to come to an analysis of this. And it was really tough work, because he was out day and night with different experiments that they tried. And at one point he just came in and said, he was so disheartened. He said, I think even if we were to provide the washrooms, they wouldn't use them. And they would still urinate and defecate in the lanes and the streets. That's how bad it had gotten. And I started this discussion with staff. I said, if we don't provide the washrooms and people urinate and defecate, that's our fault. That's our problem. If we provide them and people don't use them, we've got to think again. Because if we're developing a sense of entitlement of that sort, that things will just be provided just because they've been so badly treated, we're dehumanizing people. We're saying you don't matter. You're not part of the symphony at St. James. You're invisible. And this is a big issue for us, and it was one actually that healthcare workers really became a big battle. The science is that if people have fresh needles, you can cut the AIDS rate quite dramatically, right? HIV AIDS. So they got into this thing where they started flooding the community with needles. And needles were just being left around. It had been a principle of needle exchange, where you would take your one needle, and it wasn't always one for one, but that was the expectation, the community's value. And then suddenly, when we found out that it saved lives, we just gave them out all over the place. Well, needles were appearing in parks and playgrounds and other stuff. And it was like a form of terrorism for the families, and school teachers were having to come in early to clean up these things. It's a bad form of therapy. It's a bad way. It's saying you're invisible. You're so downtrodden and so bad, we don't even expect you to. You can injure a child. And then the answer was, well, nobody's ever died from being poked by a needle. Tell that to a parent. It didn't build support for these things. But almost more importantly, it reinforced the notion, it re-victimized people, saying, you may be too stoned to pick up your needle, but your neighbor isn't. And you can be part of a culture that does its best to take responsibility for this, so a teacher doesn't have to work an extra half hour or an hour a day when they should be with kids, even their own kids.
Well, just going to follow up on that. So it strikes me, to me, the follow-on from that is that part of community development then is about identifying shared the priorities, but also recognizing that it's not, okay, these people are the deliverers and these people are the requesters. Yeah. It's actually, it's a shared responsibility.
Yeah, and the neighborhoods here are very much aligned with that. And maybe I'll let Dan speak to that, mm-hmm. the social movement. They're yeah. very much aligned, yeah. but they're not expecting the government to come and save them, right?
Yeah, it's an asset building where everybody's got assets. How can we use them most effectively? One question I had, did this activity in the east side take place within an urban development agreement, or as it took place, you structured and got the three levels of government together and created urban development agreements?
Yeah, the program came together gradually. We tried in the early 90s. There were some dramatic things that happened. We were beginning to find out about the HIV rate. We knew there was a serious problem. There was started to be drug wars where people, it was big headlines at the time. Someone taken out in the middle of broad daylight and stabbed to death on the streets of Vancouver, and there were more shootings and that kind of stuff. So it gradually built toward a program, but we couldn't get council to commit to allowing us to do a full community plan for the whole area. So we did it bit by bit. We started with one area, and then there was this and that, and eventually we had the basis of a program. And as we started to work on that, you know, we came to the pretty obvious conclusion that most of those responsibilities were actually the senior governments, whether it was health care or housing. We didn't have the resource to do everything. But on the other hand, if we sat back and did nothing, nothing would happen. So the city called for the Vancouver. It was 1998, and by 2000 it had come into fruition. And for several years, it had its growing pains and all the rest of it, but it actually delivered quite a bit of resource. As the governments changed, that became very fragile, because the new government's priorities were all different than the ones that had signed the agreement.
I'd just like to come back about the Beasley borders, because my impression of them is completely opposite to yours. I've interacted with them a fair bit with doing street photography, and I've been really impressed with them, actually. The older borders looking after the younger borders, teaching them how to skateboard, and actually protecting the area for themselves as a recreation area. And actually, by being there enough times, making sure that the drug addicts and things aren't using their area for their purposes rather than their recreation. And they've actually come out to council meetings or Beasley Park community meetings as well to try and protect their interests. And I'd suggest that if you gave them the ownership of that park, that they'd look after cleaning it as well. Where maybe Turner Park would be a different thing because it's in a suburb where the kids are affluent and they think it is their entitlement.
It's not an affluent area. The Turner Park is not affluent. You're mistaken on that. There are a lot
of Beasley, yes.
Well, of course, yeah, but...
But the Beasley Park borders, I was really, really impressed with, and the fact that they...
I think people feel better about themselves when they are treated like everybody else. Stop holding their hands. You know, let them... I'm not referring to people with health issues, please. You know, that's a totally different situation. I'm talking about, you know, people that live in those areas. Like, when you're poor, it doesn't mean you can't clean up. I'm quite offended, quickly before we move on, I'm quite offended when I get, you know, there's going to be a garbage cleanup. I'm referring to the Beasley meeting that I was at last time. You know, if you can all come out and do... Why? Why me? I don't live there. The people that live there, give them an incentive to feel good about themselves, to take pride in their surroundings. Let them do it.
This should happen outside. So let's take advantage of the resource that we have. We've got limited time.
So it feels very familiar. So.
Fair point. You know. Anyways, so go here, and then here. I'm sorry, but that's the next three.
So I was just going to say, in response to your earlier comment, and I apologize, I don't remember your name.
Sandy.
Yeah. So I work for the public school board. And one of the things that we've experienced, and it's been wonderful, with the revitalization of our schools and the building of new schools, and I'll give one example. There was one in the downtown core that was, it was terrible. I mean, a lot of the windows were boarded up. It was a very ugly place to be. And so certainly people would not be taking pride in, understandably, the neighborhood, the children. Who cares? Throw stuff, graffiti. A lot of graffiti on the school. We built a new school. And at that time, there was a lot of crime in the neighborhood as well. Interestingly enough, this has happened with several of the new schools that have been built. When this new school, this is the first one, was built, the neighborhood, the folks around, were looking and being watchdogs. So what we ended up finding out was, there's no graffiti on that building or on these new buildings anymore, because they feel proud of their environment. They feel proud that this is something that they now have and deserve. So while there probably are many examples out there of people not caring and throwing, we've actually, at least my estimation in 6 years I've been with the board, found the opposite, that people are becoming proud of their neighborhoods, and they find ways. We have examples of communities, very high-need communities, coming together, a community, very high-need community, coming together and saying, let's do a garden day and beautify this neighborhood. So while I certainly understand that there are examples, I have a lot that I could say, surprisingly, of just saying, well, thanks for giving us, thanks for saying we're worth it. And they're doing things to build. So that would be my experience so far.
I'd be curious to see how long that continues.
Go ahead and yell.
Yeah, that's
thank
my
you.
Kind of mix. He said about the engineers doing the study about the washroom,
the studies, the people doesn't go to the washroom, doesn't matter. What if they give up and they never build the washroom? But what if they put the washroom over there, like she said, put the school there? In my country, for a long time, we don't have the cross line for pass for the in the red line for the peatons, for the walk people. So everybody was just in the middle, so was so many accidents. One mayor, he was a professor from the university, not political, so he decided to educate the people. He had a lot of assistance from the engineers to do, even to paint the street. Oh no, we don't waste the money on that because the people doesn't deserve. If they know, we don't want to waste. They put it over there, people are still crossing in the corner, in the middle of the street. So they start to put clouds on mimos in the wall. They show the people how to walk on the main path and people walk. So that then took a month, took years. I went back to my country 2 years ago and find the culture. Finally, we don't cross in the middle of the street anymore. So it's true what you say, but with this, it's not to take 1 year, 2 years, but it takes just perseverance, yeah? And of course money, and people who push in the political, put the money over there because the poor community need it. The one day, they're going to learn, and that you say, it's the future, the kids are the future. So it's responsibility for the mother, it's responsibility for the schools, but in the end, it's the responsibility for our people after the politician and the architects and the people involved like him.
Thank you.
Then to Sarah.
So I was just going to say, it's about giving people voice, right? And children need an opportunity to have a voice. And so I'm really delighted because I'm affiliated with the Sherman Hub as much as I can be and with the Jamesville Hub and trying to make my way through because it is about relationships and developing relationships and relationships with business and relationships with churches and schools. And I went to the Kathy Weaver event where they had this celebration outdoors. And it just a lovely opportunity to see services and everybody working alongside each other and building on strengths and on resilience and all of the buzzwords that are our happy words. And I grew up in Hamilton, so I was a little kid living on Tom Street, and I went to school here, and although I'm not living here, I'll probably be retiring here. And so I think we've got a lot to be proud of in Hamilton because I think we're making the right moves in terms of what we're doing. We're trying to rebuild neighborhoods. And I'm curious because you spent, I know, the morning down at McQuesten with a number of people, and I didn't hear too much about what you saw. I would have loved to have been there. But I was celebrating a third birthday of one of my wraparound families. So I was with one of our moms, and it was her third birthday, and we went to Dunder Park, and we had a celebration. So I missed what you experienced. So can you just say sort of where you were today in Hamilton?
We drove around several parts, and I didn't have a map, so I can't tell you all.
Oh, darn. Why didn't they give you a map?
I know.
The
mountain was in the wrong place.
Well, Jennifer will know.
The mountain's in the wrong place, he says.
The wrong place. So we climbed the water.
Yeah. But what I mostly saw was at the center, people really listening to each other and seemed to be respecting each other. And also that the residents were in the leadership positions, but it didn't feel like a tug of war about that. It felt that there was a fair level of respect in the room. And I hope that that lasts. I've seen that in some neighborhoods in Vancouver, but especially because of these market forces where people are feeling very at risk, you know, being pushed out, it's created a different kind of tension in some of the communities than something was in that room. But I suspect that took a lot of work to achieve that.
9 years.
Of support.
9 years.
just a thing that those relationships have to be guarded always.
And you need to have succession planning because those in leadership roles need to have people coming from behind. And we need champions. And, you know, Hamilton has those. I think we're poised in a great position to address the Pan Am Games. And there's a strong leadership sub Sherman Hub. So it's.
We'll start. Did we go next? Sorry. No, you're next. Okay. Yeah, you're next. And then
go ahead,
the gentleman in the back. And then.
Just maybe speak briefly about the politics of it.
Vancouver has different, I think still has the, we have the ward system, you have the councillors at large, and so did that make it easier, us having sort of the suburban councillors with their turf, is that going to make things harder? And also, provincially, what was the role of the provincial government? Did you, was there a lot of work to get them on board? And so I don't know, those kind of politics.
There's been a lot of just kind of evolution of whether Vancouver should have a ward system or not. And the advantage of the at-large system for us, we have 10, there's 10 councillors and a mayor. The mayor has a little bit more power because he appoints committee chairs and can set the agenda for meetings. But beyond that, he just has one vote on an issue. I think in a lot of ways, a city the size of Vancouver has probably benefited from the at-large system, and I didn't used to believe that. But I was surprised that when there was discussion of this, there was discussion about having a mix, some councillors at-large and some by ward, and I thought that would be interesting to try, because there is, you know, some communities don't get full articulation of their needs. But that was voted down. It was dismissed by the person who was doing the. They kind of had an arbitrator decide what would be put before the voters, and he took that off the list, which I never quite understood why it was taken off the list. In the Vancouver agreement, was it about the role of the provincial government?
Yeah, and funding. They put money on the table, I would imagine.
Yeah, there was. The agreement was between when the NDP was in power toward the end of its domain, and the city council had a right of center government, and the federal government was Jean Chrétien. I think he ruled since 1730 or something. I think 44 successive majority governments. It was unbelievable. And so those are the governments that came together. Most of the money that was on the table was actually federal money. That was managed jointly by the Vancouver Agreement, a small part of money. The province, though, was a partner and was supportive of a lot of the principles. And the way it worked was that, say, they did housing money, but they didn't do it through the Vancouver Agreement. They did housing. So, you know, we'd hear about a development here or there, but we weren't making decisions together about it. But they were delivering housing in a lot of it. And they also expanded health care in the community. Under their mandate. When the governments changed, the Liberal government of British Columbia, which has nothing to do with the Liberal government of Canada, it stopped funding housing for 7 years. And at the end of 7 years, there were 15,000 homeless people across British Columbia. And the whole world was coming to our province for 2010. So that created some changes in their policy later. So they were still partners in the Vancouver Agreement. They were still doing some initiatives together. Their staff were at the table, but in terms of the main things that they were responsible for, they did uphold their end of the healthcare part of it, the money and funding for innovative initiatives. On the housing one, not so much.
I think successful community strategies often come when you're not prepared for them to come, right? So I think it's sometimes about laying the foundations to allow for a particular strategy to come to fruition. So on an institutional level, for the school board, we make school space available for community groups to provide their own opportunities, do a mom-to-mom group, whatever that might be. But it's not about pushing people into that space. It's saying it's there when you're ready to use it. The other thing, when I saw the spec, I think it was yesterday, HARP now has a tool library in Janesville. Mm-hmm. Like, how great is that? That's something that I would take advantage of because, yeah, I would never go out and buy all of those things. I don't know what they are. But when I needed them, I know there's a place to go. And so I certainly wouldn't want to have a derelict property, but I wouldn't have the tools to take care of it. So there's having the resources ready at the neighborhood level and institutions providing those have to be just there, ready for when a grassroots strategy comes up.
Do you think the provincial federal government sort of came on board, had the Olympic snappy comment?
This was well before the Olympics. As a matter of fact, the fact that we were on board to some degree, it was the New Democrats actually that made the initial proposal under Glenn Clark, and then the new government picked that up as a theme.
For the Olympics.
For the Olympics, yeah. So it's something that evolved, but I don't think it wound up being an asset for them because we developed what was called the Inclusive Olympic Commitments. And the same people that were involved in the Vancouver Agreement helped develop those with the community. And that became a very important selling point when Vancouver's bid.
Past Olympics on other cities, the homeless have been displaced. Did that happen?
No. I think in fairness, that really didn't. And it was because of those commitments and the public. There was very public commitment that wouldn't happen. Also, the behavior of the police at that time, I think was in part a result of the watchdog, the role of community-based organizations in making that an issue, but the government saying that police would be properly managed, and they really did manage themselves extraordinarily well during the Olympics.
Well, and I think undoubtedly the success in not having displacement around the Olympics was probably due to the enormous amount of community organizing that came about after Expo 86 or during it, leading up to and after Expo 86, right? Because the expose was, was laid bare, just the huge impact that Expo 86 had on, many SROs, which is kind of a unique Vancouver thing, SROs, incidentally, for people who aren't familiar with them. Lots of SROs closed and went to becoming what they call them, backpackers. Hostels, which is a euphemism for we don't want low income marginally housed disabled people. We want backpackers.
Yeah, but in most cases, in Expo 86, there were people displaced from their units, and then when the owners of those places tried to rent them out to others, they couldn't. So they fixed them up, and then they had to invite their old residents back. But it still was a sense of displacement. People were disposable, which was the main message, and that became part of the political culture in the city, and contributed to why we were so concerned about it.
So one of the things I've heard about around the Vancouver Agreement is the development of a social purchasing portal. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how it came about, how it works, and what kind of benefits it has for the broader community.
Well, the notion of the social purchasing portal, it was part of, we had an economic revitalization plan. If you read it, it cross-references to the housing plan, to the health plans, and to the public realm. Because we saw them all as integrated. The drug policy talks about all those things. Our homelessness strategy. Like, all of us were thinking, with different lenses, but on the same issues and how they interrelated. So with the economic plan, a part of it had to do with trying to secure jobs, and particularly jobs for inner city residents. And one of the mechanisms we tried to use was was called the social purchasing portal. And it was like a purchaser's club. So businesses would sign up, and it was going to be web-based at the time. You'd join this, and you'd say what you had for sale, and then others could look at that and purchase it. And if you were part of that club, you were committing to hire a certain number of low-income residents, various formulas and so on. And it actually didn't work. And the reason I know it didn't work was that the main person who just put years of his life into this to do anything, like he was my critical indicator, because he would have run over your grandmother to get this to work. And I think he probably did. But he tried everything. And he couldn't get the computer-based thing to work. But we did do some other things that were related to it. So development of the Olympic Village or a major casino downtown, we made that a requirement of development, that the developers had to hire a certain number of low-income people. Blade Runners is a fairly well-known program that provides job training and on-the-job supports in the construction sphere that's kind of related to these things. And we're hoping to make that a requirement of development. So the purchasing, the procurement idea is still something that we're pursuing. We're trying, the city purchases a number of its products, considering whether people are hiring inner city or people with challenges to employment. And we're trying to make that more of a basic way of doing business and encouraging other businesses to do that. But it didn't take off in the way that we certainly hoped. And it requires a lot of hand-holding and attention. And the place, the time where I knew it was had a challenge was one of the social agencies wanted to buy paper from a company that was part of the portal. But it was going to cost her a little bit more than she could get at Staples. And she said, I'm prepared to do it, but I have to be able to know whether this company really is hiring low-income people. And that's where some of it started to break down, because people come and go. Is this, who's going to track it? How do you do it without creating a cumbersome bureaucracy? And also for the workers. So you're working for that company because you're from that neighborhood and you have an addiction. Oh, okay, that's why you got the job that I should have gotten. So there's complications that we didn't fully realize, but the principle itself, I think, is workable, but it requires kind of more growing into that. But one of the places where I think it will grow, I believe that the city will pass regulations around major development, similar to the Olympic Village, but even smaller projects that will require a certain amount of procurement from inner city businesses that hire local residents.
And that's one of the things, it's been done in Ontario, is what I was going to add to that too, in Regent Park, in the redevelopment of Regent Park. There is a proviso in the in all of the procurement around demolition and construction that they have to train and employ local residents. And similarly, given that the Regent Park redevelopment, all the commercial space, the whole thing is a 50-50 partnership between Toronto Community Housing and the developer. And so essentially they retained ownership of the commercial space, but the leases to the tenants of those commercial spaces do have some kind of a rider that says, and again, the details I'm not familiar with, but more or less I think it's something that in a community like ours makes a lot of sense as a principle, notwithstanding the implementation challenges, and it's really helpful. Well, to hear some of those.
But like an example, say with the Woodward's redevelopment, which was massive, it was one of the economic generators for the downtown east side. The security company is locally, it's a social enterprise. The people, it's associated with the Portland Hotel. So there's maintenance and other services that are being contracted. So those kind of ongoing jobs are things that we can maybe easier to do and to get developers and owners that want to be known as partnering with the community. The place where it's been most successful is with Blade Runners across British Columbia, and the construction industry has been very actually excited about that program because it gives them access to workers that they wouldn't have access to without it, and it doesn't cost them hardly anything in relation
kind of
to
the huge business. Support that helps the workers get there and maintain developers all
of it. Okay, are there union objections? So?
No, I think at least when there was a considerable labor shortage, it was too busy working.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was a period of time in Vancouver where it was impossible to get almost impossible to get any work done because there were so few.
By the way, if you want a lesson from the Olympics, don't do a major construction of housing while you're doing, like the Olympic Village, while you're doing major construction of about 40 other things that are needed to take on the Pan Am Games or whatever. Yeah. Because the labor becomes scarce, materials become scarce, and the cost goes through.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is that for a community like Hamilton, well, first of all, one thing that's really interesting about that is that it's no added cost, right? So this kind of economic activity is going to happen. It's the added cost is very low in terms of, but the benefit is great. And so that's one thing. And then, as you say, I mean, we might actually be on the verge of some kind of a construction boom, in which case we will get into, who knows, right? But we may get into labor problems and so forth, in which case this becomes actually a solution to the problem and not just a sort of feel-good enterprise, right?
But I wonder, though, Jim, and there is added cost because of the need for social services support
sure.
for some of the folks.
There's a portion of it is paid by the industry or the developer, a portion of it is paid by the provincial government.
Yeah.
But the benefits far out. It's a relatively small cost, but there is staffing that has to...
But that means
that piece
always needs to be in there.
Well, it needs to be in there, but the piece is that what changes is who's coming through. Because, like, we have grandkids who go through
Yeah, you see, in Hamilton, we have something similar in that you still have to qualify, you still have to have a history of homelessness, right?
Yes, what happens with these kids is if they get the skills, they actually become part of the regular labor force at some point.
Yes.
If they need leg runners again, leg runners is available to them again, but it's not a lifelong thing.
Yeah.
It's until they have the skills and the history and so on, that then they're the union.
Right. And if it's done by a social enterprise rather than a for-profit enterprise, the profit margin can be devoted to some of those added costs that you're talking about with our debt. Right?
Sure.
So again, you know, these are implementation details, but I think that certainly the spirit of it, if Dr. Drew seemed to me that would be a sensible thing to try and encourage.
The Health in the Hubs group, that's the one thing that the question where you were this morning is social enterprise, and that's what they're doing, the evidence-based strategies with the woman who's teaching the course and the students. So they're working on that in one neighborhood. So that's an additional piece. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Well, all I'm saying is that my brother lives up by the Boundary Road by the Civic Coliseum, and I was out there during the Olympics. He has a house that's on the slope that goes down to the Transcan Trail, and what he was saying to me is, don't go into any of the back alleys or don't carry a knapsack, because we've had so many break-ins in our area from throughout the ocean crack people who live in this area where you're doing all your work. So as a Vancouverite who's lived there for 25 years, he's saying that this is kind of this core of all these bad people that are going out in the suburbs and breaking into homes and saying,
Sky train. And the newspaper says it's spreading AIDS.
Has that changed? Yeah, there's a terrific fear in his neighborhood that everybody is breaking into these homes.
I'm not sure about the specific instance. The one thing I've learned from the police, though, is when there's a big spike in break-ins, usually they can trace it to two or three people. It's amazing how industrious some of the criminals are. But the fact is that people, like at the supervised injection site, people are, injecting illegal drugs, and they steal, for the most part, to get the money to pay for those drugs. They're stealing from somewhere. And the more successful experiment, I think, was when they were giving out free drugs, believe it or not. It was more successful in the sense that it actually got a higher proportion of people into treatment. Because nobody likes to sit in the doctor's office two or three times a day.
Also, if you're not having to spend your whole day trying to get the money to buy the drugs, it gets pretty boring.
Well, it's true. I was the founding director of the Managed Alcohol Program here. There's only three in Canada. So it's very similar, except it's not illegal. So we provide alcohol to alcoholics, for people who have been homeless. And so what we found was abstinence rates start increasing over a couple of years, right? And you think all of a sudden people are abstaining, right? Because they don't. If there is a boredom factor, but there's many factors to that. But that was, it's very interesting because you say all of a sudden it's not like my life is not about going from one bottle to the next.
And also the fact that they're going to a health facility
is
taking a step forward in their life, just saying that I'm worth something.
Yes, the community people.
The Housing First people say the same thing, right? When they first started the Housing First experiment in Pathways to Housing in New York, one of the things they said is like, okay, we gave people housing, and we didn't require anything else of them, right? They didn't have to do treatment, they didn't have to do anything else. And then, we just visit. The only requirement was we had to visit them once a week. Yeah. And, after two or three weeks, they said, like, I'm thinking about getting some treatment for my substance abuse problem because I'm bored. And there was a famous quote, I think it was Oscar Wilde, who said, the problem with being poor is it takes up all of your time. Which it really does. It's funny how
it's addiction cycle, it's relationships. I think that thing about community that you said is huge. You develop relationships, the community, so the insight is experiences.
And the thing that, people notice when you don't show up.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah. That's a drummer. Or
I was saying this morning that the middle session we had that our daughter-in-law just works for the for-profit society, and she found her first body. Now, that body was found when it was, because Portland's policy is that if they haven't seen someone for who lives in their housing for a certain number of hours, they do a room check on them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And doing a room check means that you go in and you're face-to-face with Joe and say, how are you doing, Joe? This is an entirely different thing.
Yes.
You're in relationship with someone the other day.
It's a very interesting.
It's a huge piece.
Yeah, just having somebody follow you. I think of this from studies, right? Almost every study, the control arm improves.
It does.
But the people who don't get the intervention actually improve. Yeah. Why is that? Well, my only answer is that because there's two things. One is they're being monitored, right? So, and they know they're being monitored. Mm-hmm. And that introduces a mindfulness that otherwise wouldn't be there, right? About, oh, how am I doing, right? Somebody's looking at them, how action, and then they actually think to themselves, how am I doing? Mm-hmm. So, anyways. Jen, fire.
I have a question about LRT. Whatever might happen in Hamilton with LRT, tomorrow might tell. You were involved in that, and I've been involved in some design charrettes in my neighborhood in terms of what the land use is going to be like. And in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking inclusive neighborhoods and how do we build this in. So I would love to hear your perspective in terms of how do we build inclusivity into our nodes and corridors planning around LRT.
Well, one is you can have a bylaw that doesn't allow development unless it contains a certain proportion of affordable rental or low-income housing. The challenge is that the welfare rates are so low that the subsidies that you need for market development are way beyond what can be achieved. You need real money to do that, or the government should increase the housing component of welfare. Either way, you just need more money. Then, if you do it through development, you're getting just ginormous buildings that you probably wouldn't be able to sell anyway. But putting in for affordable rental, or some people are more supportive of this than I am. But affordable home ownership is another possibility. I think the whole question of what home ownership really means is going to be going under a reconsideration as the economy wavers a bit. But affordable rental housing for sure, and. As requirements. The partnership with that, and there's an interesting group in Vancouver, and I think they're part of a nationwide movement, but certainly within British Columbia, there's a lot of municipalities signing on to this, to ask the federal government to put a focus on low-income and affordable rental housing. And remember, for those of us old enough, the MERV program, which had some challenges to it, but basically delivered a huge amount of affordable rental housing across the country. So the combination of you can't build condos without a certain proportion of affordable rental, but then also having some of the federal tax incentives that would make it attractive as well to build it. There was another thing we talked about this afternoon was there are implicits, in Vancouver at least, there are implicit subsidies, and it probably is true here too, for condo development. Like if you're an owner of an apartment building, you have an accountant, and you work through, okay, I'm going to own this building, or somebody's going to own it in 20 or 50 years, I'm going to have to replace the elevator, the roof, this, that. When you come in and you're looking at that beautiful view out of the escarpment and the little balcony that they give you, and maybe a nice, Bob Rennie, who's our leading market, said, you can jack up the price by thousands of, tens of thousands of dollars just by putting in stainless steel okay, so you see that, but you're not thinking about how do you pay for the elevator. And the provincial law doesn't require the developer to hand over a significant contingency fund. So people wind up putting in $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 more over time, and maybe in times when they can't really afford it. But it's a big advantage to the condo owner, because the condo developer, because he's taking that extra money that an apartment owner couldn't bid for the land, because the apartment owner knows he has to pay for the... The lack of knowledge on the part of the naive homeowner in condos makes it possible for the developer to pay more for the land.
Or the lack of consumer protection.
What?
Yeah. Or the lack of that consumer protection.
Well, I say ignorance, but protect, greater protection too. But then a wise apartment... rental apartment owner. He can't afford to pay so much because he has to set aside that money for future improvements.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and the
contingency fund and the amount that's going in from the condo fees is not sufficient, and it's actually, it's gained in order to keep the prices at something that the market will bear, but that also preserves the profit for the developer, and the long-term consequences are that you might have just kind of random, to continue living here, you have to cough up $20,000 that you weren't planning on. Yeah, so yeah, no, that happens, and well, leaky condos was an exceptional example of that in Vancouver. Any other questions, thoughts? It's a very good point, though.
To exhaustion. Thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, thank you, Nathan. I really, really appreciate it, and thanks for your question.
We just take two.
That was the question.
I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to be there.